and welcome to the Pocket Gamer Podcast. It's episode number 520, let's say. My name is James Gilmore, and we have the return of Rick Cowley.
You can't keep me gone for long.
Yeah, you're here, and so is my neighbour and his exciting drilling antics. Anyone who watched last week or listened knows that I was complaining about it, and the DIY continues unabated. So, if you start to hear... in the middle of this, we're just going to have to run with it and work it into the show.
That was impressively accurate for a drill. You've been practicing this.
It's not so much practicing as listening to it for 4 weeks straight while I try to work. I'm like, what's the birds that repeat things? Budgerigars? I'm like that. I go, and then I say something cute, except for me, it's just running up behind people going in their ear. Less endearing by some stretch. How have you been, Rick? It feels like a while since we've had you. We've had Dan and we've had Matt back and forth a bit, but I don't know.
Yeah, maybe I think it was like 3 weeks ago that I was last on. I'm doing well as can be. I got thoroughly owned this morning.
Just another Friday.
Our internet isn't the greatest, so me and my partner sort of have to divide our time if we're doing calls. So when I do the podcast, she's sort of not allowed to do anything else on the internet. And she has a Friday morning coffee morning. Then I asked her to, you know, jump off after half an hour so that I could take over the internet. And one of the people in part of the coffee morning went, oh, you have a boyfriend that does a podcast. And I was like, wow.
Oh. Yeah, destroyed. Yeah, you and by extension me have been completely owned there. That's like saying you watch Joe Rogan. It's like, oh no. You're one of them, are you? Oh god. Well, I was going to say that your footage looked a little bit jerkier than usual, but I didn't want to rub it in. Luckily, we've got audio, so no one will notice. I feel really bad now that I've like kicked your girlfriend off like essential socializing time, which is really important for keeping everyone sane at the moment.
It's so fine. She gets 2 weeks usually in between these bits.
Oh, okay. So it's all good. True. Yeah, it's gotta suck it up. Yeah. Men are talking on the internet. That's what men do, right?
This is more important than your life. I'm going to get kicked after this.
Ah, she's in the background. I can hear you. This is extreme irony for anyone watching / listening and has their fingers over the cancel button. Right. Let's crack on with this absolute shit show. And I'm not beeping it because I don't care anymore. Let's talk about things like a ridiculous amount of money coming to Fortnite from none other than not Epic, but Sony. We're going to chat a little bit about another game being made into a TV show. Let's see if you can guess which one it is. Clue, it's dumb. We've got information about Sky Children of the Light. We've got Rebel Inc. bringing its campaign over to mobile. Plus, a whole bunch of new releases, including the like of Thronebreaker, The Witcher Tales, Battle Legion, Wave Redux, Emergent Fates, and more. But first, the news. Fortnite continues to make money. End story. Should we move on?
It's been a good podcast.
It's been a good show, man.
A pleasure coming back. I'll see you next week.
I'll tell your girlfriend to get back on and rejoin the book club. Right, yeah. So this is a slightly different take on the whole thing. Yes, of course, Fortnite continues to be the biggest thing in the entire world. Two things Fortnite related, actually. The first one is that they've had a massive investment that's come in from Sony. Who've chucked $250 million into the game. Now, the thing that this has been described as is strategic investment. I mean, I don't know how that differs from... are they doing games strategic as opposed to first-person investment? Or, I don't know, card game... I don't know what it means. What they've said, and this is from old Tim Sweeney, is it's this chat about the technology being amazing. So Epic's powerful technology in areas like graphics places them at the forefront of game engine development. Unreal Engine, yada, yada, yada. This is from the Sony Corporation CEO. Through our investment, we'll explore opportunities for further collaboration to bring value to customers in the industry at large, blah, blah, blah. So is this just like them getting their foot in to be like, if we work directly with Epic, their game engine in general, then it means that we'll get... What does it mean? Because they already used it, they invent the game engine to use it anyway. What's their benefit from this?
I'm not entirely sure. So one of the things I've seen people saying is like, oh, well, maybe it'll be a case of... You know, you could see improvements to how Unreal works with PS5 is kind of the main thing that people are going with, because if you've got a stake in a company, then you can sort of say, well, you know, we'll work with you on the PS5 and get the architecture all meshed together better, and there'll be improvements on there that you won't find on Xbox or other consoles and that kind of thing. But that's not possible. Mobile, so we're not talking about that. Other than that, I don't really see much of a point, because I saw someone pointing out that basically Epic at this point is valued at something like $14.7 billion. Sony have just invested $250 million, which is like about 2% of an investment, which is nothing. Like, Sony will have absolutely no say in anything that Epic does. And it'll be more like a case of like, oh, we'll see like a tiny amount of revenue come back to us from Fortnite, possibly.
It's keeping them sweet.
Yeah.
I find it funny because previously, Sony were the real holdout when it came to things like cross-platform.
Mm.
They were the ones when it came to Fortnite being like, want to play everywhere. Like, Microsoft was like, yeah, fine, go for it. Fill your boots. And the same thing with the mobile platforms. Sony were the ones going, nope, we're not playing, we're not having any of this. Mm. And now they're like, oh, Epic, we love you, come here. Do cross-platform all you like, bring all your silly emotes onto our PS5.
Yeah, because it was Fortnite that like forced them to do that, because it was such a huge game that they needed to sort of bend to that will. And then it was only after Fortnite started being cross-platform on PS4 that all the other games started going cross-platform as well. So yeah, it's an interesting move. I guess it's more of a sign that Sony is sort of opening itself up to different avenues and isn't going to restrict in on itself much. Emotes.
I think the Unreal Engine, that was the one that got shown, Unreal 5, that's the one that got shown as a demo, that 8-10 yes. minute demo they put out months ago. That was on PS5, I think, wasn't it? Wasn't the architecture being demoed on that?
I think they've got
a partnership going on already with them. So, getting involved in Epic as well. Either way, loads of money being thrown their way. We're not entirely shocked. This goes hand in hand with the odd news that guess who gets an emote before anyone else does? OnePlus owners. That's who. If you're playing Fortnite on your OnePlus, you get the Bollywood-inspired Bhangra Boogie dance before anybody else does. Which has been demoed in a video that we were sent and I uploaded to the YouTube channel of here he comes, listen. Yeah. Still staying in, baby. He's not drilling, that's just hammering. We'll see how it goes. Of the Peely, the banana character, doing the dance. We've got an exclusive trailer. It's on the channel. Go and find the story. It's a banana dancing.
That is bananas.
It's what the kids like. Apparently, I don't play Fortnite, so you know it is what it is. The thing that made the whole thing a bit more interesting was there's a 90 FPS mode. This is something that talking about collaborating with Epic. That specific is this again specific to OnePlus, where they get a 90 frames per second mode and no one else does?
I, to be honest, have not looked at the story
because I think it don't know. Looks like it. It kind of looks like it. Because obviously, Nintendo Switch, the best you get out of it is 30 frames per second. So, like, 90 frames per second on a handset, mobile handset, is quite impressive in comparison. But, go and watch a banana dancing if that's really a thing that you want to do. There was a newsy thing that you were going to talk about, I feel.
Yes. Crash Bandicoot on the Run has been officially revealed.
Right. Now, this is for which
platform? You seem like you don't care, and I'm...
It's not that I don't care. I mean, you're right, I don't care. But I'm more interested in, like, is this Switch?
This is mobile. This is their much-rumoured mobile thing. It was sort of leaked in February that they were working on something. And then it started going... I think it went into soft launch a few months ago, all very hush-hush on the quiet. And then on Wednesday, they posted something to a Twitter account that nobody had noticed before. And then yesterday, they officially announced it. It's got a shiny new trailer. Crash Bandicoot's on your mobile. Everyone's getting very worried. So it's
worried?
Yeah, it's a 3-lane auto runner, basically.
I'm about to ask, and yes.
With all the usual, you know, jump between lanes, jump up, slide to go under things, attack enemies. You can craft weapons to use against enemies, I believe. It'll have uh-huh. classic bosses from the old games and probably locations inspired by all of the games. Different skins that you can unlock and probably buy. So if you pre-register now, which is open on Google Play, and soon on iOS, you'll get an exclusive blue hyena skin for your pre-registration. No date yet, but if they're opening pre-registration, it'll probably be within about a month. Yeah.
Okay.
It's a video game.
So, like, you were relating my slight look of disinterest. It's not that I don't, like, hate Crash Bandicoot or anything, just I was never into it. However... Mm. Is this franchise not absolutely perfect for this kind of game? Because isn't the original Crash Bandicoot basically a single lane runner anyway?
Yeah.
Like, that's what the game is. It's just he's locked onto a path and he runs towards the camera and you have to do the jumping. Now, this one's, they're going to have to flip it. They're going to have to stick the camera behind him. But apart from that, that's what the game was. Him just like, jump a box, like.
Pretty much.
This is just moving the camera to the other side and putting it on mobile, no?
Well, the camera was usually behind him anyway, but I'll allow you that transgression. They did both, so there was the classic sort of image you remember of Crash is running towards the screen from a boulder.
Yeah.
But there were, like, they had side-on levels, they had facing levels as well. It's like camera behind.
Okay.
So, you know, they could actually do quite a few things. Maybe there'll be some side-on levels as well. That would be a nice little treat. Homage to the old secret levels and stuff like that. Yeah, I think it could work. I think we were talking about this in the Pokegamer.biz podcast. Matthew is pointing out that it has a very, like, Crash has a very specific feel for when you land a jump and when you do that, and it needs to sort of nail that game feel if it's going to be anything like a good Crash game. I personally would have loved to have seen it more in the style of like Rayman Mini and Rayman Run and all that kind of stuff with the whole side on auto runner thing, because I think they've done platforming really well, as I think we've talked about before. I worry it's going to end up being like that Lara Croft three lane runner that I remember launching a few years ago and was utter trash and everybody immediately forgot about it.
I had forgotten about it, actually, because I think the memory of Lara Croft Go, which was a really, really good game, kind of pushed out the bad thoughts, the bad touch that came from that previous game. But yeah, it's for one of the default genres everyone goes to. There's Match 3 Puzzler, there's Auto Runner, and those are your go-to. And then there's that general, like, city management thing that you get from, like, Simpsons Tapped Out and Family Guy and all that lot. Those the three ones I think of when you're like, what should we do for mobile? And they just, like, you know, spin a bottle, and it's one of those three game genres. But then this, it looks all right. It looks like, you know, it looks like your Subway Surfers and all the rest of it. The cartoony style suits it great. It looks like they've put a bit of love into it. And I genuinely, the game's perfect for it, really.
There is rumours, however, that there's, like, wait timers and stuff. Yeah. So obviously it's going to be free to play, you know, that's totally fine. King are making it. King have done Candy Crush for years. They know how to make a free to play game. They know how to do all that kind of thing. Wait timers, I think we kind of have moved past, like, as people who play mobile games, I think we're beyond that point now where wait timers are of any interest to anybody. And I think it would be better if they didn't have them. But so it goes. That's only rumors. Yep. They might have taken them out. It's still in soft launch, so they're still sort of like testing the waters and seeing what works and what doesn't. So don't believe anything you read until the game actually launches, because these things change massively while they're still being tested. But yeah, it could be an interesting
soft launch. Yeah, I'll have to give it a go then. I'll give that a punch.
I think now, it's like last... in New Zealand on Android, so it's like nigh on impossible to get. Yeah.
Never mind then. Getting around the area stuff is easy on iOS, or so I'm told. But the Android is a bit more of a pain in the ass, so forget it then.
A bit more illegal.
We talked last week about games being pushed into TVs. So, like, we specifically talked about the Westworld creators going on and doing a Fallout TV show, where they were going to try and, like, make it funny, do a dark comedy kind of tint on the whole post-apocalypse thing. Well, Electronic Arts has now got their next franchise lined up to spit into your faces on TV. And the one they've gone for is The Sims. So they've partnered with TBS to make a reality TV show based on The Sims.
If I'm not mistaken, it's like watching people play The Sims, right? I think it's...
Right. So it's like Gogglebox, where people's watching TV, watching other people watching TV, only it's going to be them all competing to play one another in The Sims. The thing I don't understand is, like, The Sims is not a competitive game, right? Mm. Sims is a game where you just build your own world and, you know, bimble about in it. And has there ever been, like, a multiplayer thing with The Sims where you go other to... where you go and meet other people's Sims like you can do with Animal Crossing?
I'm sure there was a Sims MMO either in development or that actually happened. But no, in terms of, like, traditional Sims, there hasn't been, like, a multiplayer online option or any sort of competitive modes or anything. I guess what they'll kind of be doing is more of a, like, competitive building kind of thing, and it'll be a design challenge and that kind of thing. Because it's got, like, three judges, and one of them's a Sims streamer and one of them's design expert or something. I don't really remember. Right. I kind of looked at this story and went, what? And then moved on with my life. But yeah, I think it's going to be like it's a four-part series, so very short, with eight streamers taking part in it. And I think, yeah, it's going to be more of a design competition and that kind of thing. I think it'll be interesting. It sounds like my kind of trash.
Oh, God. Everything I read about it makes me want to die slightly more. So it features 12 online personalities. Oh, so dear. Not like... So online exclusive. So, right, okay. Games community competing to impress a number of celebrity judges. Right, kill me. It's being hosted by American Idol finalist Ravon Owen. Not a clue. Well, YouTube personality Kelsey Impikishi? That's a good surname. Hang on. Impikishi? I've got it wrong. No offense, but whatever that is. I don't know who that is. Singer-songwriter Tyler Parks. Maxis developer Dave Miotic. I don't know anybody. I don't know any of these people. I don't care about The Sims. I don't want to watch celebrities choosing the color of their sofa. What is this? Was this what we've been lowered to? What's the point of any of this, Rick? What's going on?
I can't answer that question. Look, I know that there are people out there who, like, there are, like, Simfluencers, I believe, who, like, make careers out of, you know, making lovely things in Sims and setting up houses and stuff. My partner herself, like, really loves getting into The Sims 4 and just basically, like, building nice houses and stuff. Doesn't actually play the game, just turns on cheats and builds a nice house, takes a couple of screenshots, and then doesn't play for a month. So I think it'll be that kind of, that feel to it, where it's going to be like, here's infinite money, build a house kind of thing. And it'll, you know, I guess there'll be, like, certain rules and guidelines that you have to follow, and a certain theme that you have to hit, and all this kind of stuff. And I think that kind of thing will be interesting. I think watching people do it for half an hour is going to be super boring.
I am extremely not into this. It's just a presentation of it as a show. The idea of, like, an hour-long stream of someone just kind of quietly putting together their house and, you know, stuff set to chill music, like, that I can get on board with. Like, obviously, we make videos for YouTube. It's like, you know, Let's Plays and all that. I get this. But it's going to be done in that shoom, like, reality. Three judges, the camera panning along, shoom, shoom. They'll play a bit of Coldplay. Someone will cry and tell them about how their mother's ill. And so, I really want to win this Sims competition. Shut up. All that stuff. I can't deal with it. It's the worst form of entertainment. and I hope it gets cancelled. Anyway, moving on. Let's talk about something nice. Sky, Children of the Light, hits 20 million downloads ahead of its one-year anniversary celebration. It's not even been out for a year yet. In my head, it's been around for slightly longer than that.
I think it was in soft launch for like a year and a half,
maybe,
and it was announced a long time ago, and it just kind of took its time to get out, and then is very slowly been released on other platforms. So it's been on iOS for a year, but it's only just come out on Android, and it's coming to Switch at some point, and all this kind of stuff. So it always feels new every time they mention it, because it just kind of like disappears out of your conscious mind, I think. And again, I still haven't played it. Because I'm bad, and I know I would love it, but
it's nice. It's very nice. They did it well. Again, talking about stuff that's chill and just a nice place to drift into and escape for a while. Yeah, that's great. So the first anniversary comes around soon. It was only that's mad. It's been downloaded 5 million times, I think, on Android, and the rest has been on iOS. They're going to do a big anniversary thing, I think. So the 13th to the 19th of July, there are going to be multiple events for existing and new players alike. You can go and read like about specifically what they are. Plus, you get the new season coming to coming soon, which is the Season of Sanctuary, which apparently takes place on the Daylight Prairie Realm, which is a vacation-style island. Which I can seriously get on board with. That's what it is. Go and chill. I've been finding myself drawn towards games where it's like you go and explore a jungle, or there's like big expansive wildlife. I finished that Tomb Raider game and I was quite sad because I was running around a jungle and I had the surround sound and everything, and it was like all the noises and the birds and the wind, and I was like, ah, yeah, this is nice. After being locked in a box for ages, this feels lovely. I want to spend more time here. So you can go and check that out over on both Android and iOS. Clearly, it's been running for ages. A couple of other things that are coming out soonish. So we've got Rebel Inc., which is going to bring a campaign mode to mobile. And they're currently looking for beta testers. So Rebel Inc., this is the same crew, Endemic Creations, who also did Plague Inc., which has proved, you know, insanely popular for a long time, which I guess itself was kind of a riff on Pandemic, the board game. I always felt like that one was inspired by the other. But either way, Plague Inc.'s done really well. Rebel Inc. is the military strategy version of it. So the same kind of world map and global scale, but you're doing military campaigns and fighting off insurgencies rather than like cultivating viruses and stuff like that. This is something that's going to be, say, beta testing soon. You can download the original game, so Plague Inc.'s obviously available. I'm trying to see where you sign up for the beta. So we've embedded a tweet here, and there's literally a GDoc form. That's what the link is. But you can add your name to that and get involved, and you can start beta testing it over both on iOS and on Android. So you're not going to get locked out by platform on that one. So maybe have a little look. I feel like there was something else. Was there anything else good that happened?
I don't remember.
One thing I wanted to mention. I want to draw attention to this because I haven't really picked up on it before. So we don't talk about Apple Arcade as much. Like when we do the top fives over on PG.com, we don't include the Apple Arcade because we can't assume everyone's got it. So we only cover games where you can, if you've got an Android or iOS device, you can either download it for free or buy it. Because saying it's all on Apple Arcade is kind of quite exclusive. However, we do a weekly update article. So we include like updates for all the games that have already been added to the service. And being as it's a subscription and you're paying for these games anyway, like even if you play it for a bit and go, ugh, and move on, it's good to know when the new stuff pops up because you're paying a fiver a month and, you know, this is what you're funding. You're funding these updates. So, for example, there was a LEGO Brawls update that came out. There was an update for Legend of the Skyfish 2, which brings like 6 different ports to the game to take players to different areas where they'll have special challenges. You've got stuff for Manifold Garden, which was a really interesting looking first person puzzler where you could walk on the walls and the ceilings. Really lo-fi. I really liked it. They've added a photo mode because part of the game is the fact that it looks so unusual and so striking. Skate City's got an update. So just something to bear in mind. Go over to PG and maybe bookmark this thing because we return to it regularly and it's really good to know the good stuff is getting additional content. Go play the games you like, but more. Out and about this week. Battle Legion. So I don't know if it's got soft launched a while back, but because some people have been playing it for longer. Dan certainly has had a build of this. He's been playing for a while and he's been singing its praises. I've played it and you've played it. I want to get your opinion first. What are we thinking on Battle Legion?
I think it's really interesting and I'm also confused by it. So it's kind of... So if you've not played it, it's a game, it's kind of like an auto battler, like the auto chess games that have been coming out, but less confusing. So you've got your little army and you can dot them about and you put them around and I've got to put my archers at the back and put a wall in front of them and put some stabby people at the front and a big hulking great guy there. And then you spin basically a roulette wheel and it lands on another army and then you just watch them fight. And then whoever wins, like, you either win or you lose, and you get some coins for taking part, and you get some experience if you win. And then you can, like, eventually unlock shards and gold, and you can use those to buy new people, upgrade the units that you do have, spin again. You just keep doing that over and over and over again. I think that element really works. I guess, like, if you're not into games that play themselves, then you're not going to be into this, because it is very much a game where you just kind of, like, set it up and then just sit back and watch. I believe there's even, like, an auto spin option where you just set it to run and then it will just go through game after game after game after game.
I didn't see that. Okay.
I think, yeah, you get, like, a certain number of, like, auto spin coins at some point. Once you get out of the tutorial section, then you can use that as just an auto thing. I think that's kind of interesting. The thing I don't understand is, like, the whole shard business, in that you only really get these shards and stuff when you rank up and unlock boxes, or when you buy boxes, that kind of thing. So you can only change your army if your army's doing good, because you need to get XP to unlock the boxes, like, organically, or spend money. And I think that aspect of it I don't really like, because it's kind of like, I have this army, it's doing okay, but then I get absolutely demolished by, like, a pack of rabid dogs or something like that that I just can't fight against. I have nothing that can possibly stop them. So I just kind of, have to just hope that, you know, the next person you fight isn't involved in the whole wild dog meta or whatever like that. And I guess that's kind of what the random element does, because obviously it just throws you into a battle and then you could end up against anybody, and then you know, you might win, you might lose, and that's kind of a cool thing. But it's just, I don't like the way you unlock items, and I would prefer it if some of the gold that you unlock in the game could also be used to buy more shards, so you can more easily access these units. That's my entire
units and get newer units.
Yeah, that's my entire feelings about Battle Legion.
Right. Okay. So I get the sense that some of that, if you're not into these kind of games, was aimed at me, which I understand. However, I instantly got this. I think this is great. And generally speaking, I don't like games that, inverted commas, play themselves. This really works for me.
Yeah.
Because there is. It is strategic because it's about placement, and the placement where you put, and I messed around with the same army, like me just moving things a little bit left and put him right at the front and put my big battle out there. Because if you've not played the game at all, it's like split into two sides. You play it landscape mode, left and right. Your army's on that side, their army's on that side. Say a range of forts, your different groups, your archers and your soldiers and your big battle-y hammer dude. And then when you say you spin a roulette wheel, this is why I really like the game. It's one of the reasons it properly works for me. Like the entire left side of the screen, so their army, that page, that bit with the their battlefield on it, you swipe that and it spins. Mm-hmm. Like it's like you're rotating through photos of different battle scenes, and then locks into your next battle, and then go. Now the battles are really quick. The whole thing is over in like sort of probably 10-15 seconds, like really quick. The characters themselves are teeny tiny little dudes. I think of things like, if you're old, sensible soccer. If you're young and sexy, then maybe Kingdom Rush and that lot, where it's like the cartoon characters where they move really fast and skip along. The battles happen so fast that they're just fun and frenetic to enjoy, and all the screaming and everything, and they start laying into each other. And I know there's been like a battle sim that was doing the rounds like a few months ago, with that massively multiplayer battle thing where you just throw loads of people into an army and then press go, and everyone was trying to crash their computer by adding like thousands
accurate battle simulator, I think.
So it's got like a sousson of that, a little bit of it, where you're just like putting a load of troops in there and pressing go and watching them scrum, but really, really quickly. The fact that you spin through the armies, because I know what you mean about like shards are required in order for you to start like unlocking other things. And it can feel a bit like a bit of a crapshoot, like a bit of a random thing. But there's something about spinning the armies up that goes, this is kind of a bit of a, not a gamble, but this is chance. It's like emphasizing in its design that what happens here, you could win, you could lose. It's not necessarily just down to how well you spec your army out. But equally, when I went through a streak of like losing with, I was losing like battle after battle after battle, and then I saw, all right, then I'll move this guy and shift this guy around here, won the next three. Like, and I could see what was working. I could see the fact by dragging my hammer dude right out to the front. Every time the archers went to draw and they were just about to unleash, he hit. And it causes them to all jump in the air and bounce back, and it, like, stunlocks them.
Mm.
And I was like, right, okay. So putting him right at the front really helped, and suddenly I was winning. So all of that stuff genuinely does have an effect on your strategy, beyond just, yes, you can then upgrade the characters, and it's similar to Clash Royale in so much as you need coins and that to upgrade your characters, but also you can unlock extra ones, and then you have a limited amount of space on the battlefield, so you have to work out, like, well, this big hammer dude, he costs 2 points and I've only got 7, so I need to, you know, arrange it appropriately. It was, like, fast and fun and immediate, and the battles are really quick and entertaining. I felt like I was having an effect on the outcome. It didn't feel like it was stitching me up too much. And when I started to move things around, I did see results without even upgrading anything. I really like it.
Again, that
completely
caught
me by surprise. I was just like, I've played it, like, way more this morning than I should have, just because I was like, no, this is addictive and easy and light, and it's so quick and responsive, and gives you an immediate, like, little shot of something. It makes the brain go fizz just the right amount.
I agree. It is something you can, even if, like, you're not going to get bogged down in all the unlocking new units and all that kind of thing and spending hours of your time doing all that. Even just the immediate sort of thing of spinning that wheel, playing that battle, it's like, oh, actually, this feels really nice. Like, the gameplay itself feels really nice. I just feel like the metagame around it could do with some tweaking and make it a little bit easier to get into in that regard. But I think overall, like, it's really cool. It's a really inventive way of doing the auto battler and just making it that much faster, as you say, like 10-15 second battles rather than like auto chess, which takes like half an hour to get through one fight. This is like you could get through 100 fights in that time and you would have just as much fun. I think that's really, really interesting, and I think this could go places. If enough people like get on board with it, this could be a huge, huge game.
That's what I thought. I was like, it probably, like, naturally when you say these things, probably it isn't. But it has got that germ of like, if this caught on just right, this could be massive. Really into it. I totally get why Dan took to it, and I was all ready to go and go, yeah, whatever. Play it. I like to play my games, lol.
Yeah.
But no, I do feel like I'm playing it. This is good stuff. So Battle Legion, that's iOS and Android, and that's free to play. I'm sure balancing has to be done. I'm sure maybe you hit a wall after 3 weeks. I don't know. But first, like, kind of the first blush of it, great stuff. Really enjoying it. Something else that both you and I have played, Wave Redux.
Yes.
So, the question is, did you play the original Wave?
I did not. So, I had no idea what this was going in.
Right, okay. So, backstory, Wave was a game that came out post-Flappy Bird, I think. Not that it makes a lot of sense. It's comparable in so much as you put your finger on the screen and you're presented with kind of a bunch of... It's a screen, like, rather than built of hexagons, like kind of a hex-based thing, it's like a triangle-based thing. So it's like a grid made of triangles. And you are yourself a little kind of arrow, and it's got that almost snake aspect to it where it leaves a trail. It's got like a triangle train shunting up the screen. And then you hold your finger on the screen to make it go up, and then you release, and it goes down at a 90-degree angle. And then hold up, down, and so you zigzag your way through a maze. Now, the first one, Wave, was, like, incredibly fast-paced. It was like that, the navigation mechanic similar to what you see in Flappy Bird, but crossed with Super Hexagon, where it's lo-fi visuals, really, like, frenetic, kaleidoscopic, like, strobing visuals, and it was super fast, and it was designed to completely mess you up. It was really good. Genuinely really good as well. This is like that, only let's turn the lights down, let's close the curtains, let's light some candles and maybe spark up something else, and we're gonna kick back and ooh, pretty colors and it's like the chillax, we the third club we've been to and they've just started to play the really low-key sort of minimalist ambient tunes, and now I'm gonna play Wave Redux.
Yes. No, I would totally agree with that. Like, I was playing it thinking, wow. Like, as I was playing it, I was like, oh, so this is Flappy Bird meets Super Hexagon, basically. Which I don't think is an unfair comparison, because it does have the same sort of Flappy Bird mechanic, as you were saying, and the Super Hexagon style. And I think it does a lot with those to make it its own sort of whole thing. Yeah. And like the visuals are gorgeous. Like it just the it is like this weird, mellow, trippy aesthetic and bright colours and everything's sort of waving around and that kind of thing. I think that was really lovely. But as you say, yeah, I went straight in for the. I was looking because as you when you hit play, it's like, oh, do you want to play casual? Do you want to play hard? Do you want to play regular? And I was like, I'll go for casual. That seems like what you're pointing me towards. And it is just this relaxed, chilled out environment with some nice ethereal music playing, and you're moving up and down and gently snaking your way through the environment. And there's no like there's no set path or anything. There's all sorts of different routes you could be taking, and as you go through, you see all the power ups that you sort of missed and all the different pickups that you could have had and that kind of thing. And it's like, oh, well, maybe if I die and go back, I can try a different route this time and that kind of thing. And I think that it feels really chilled. It's also still really hard. Even it on the tough. Chilled out thing, like I the first time I played it, I lost all three of my lives within about a minute of starting. And then I finally was like, right, okay, I understand now. I can see the line that you actually follow when you're holding and like which directions I need to go in. And you have to sort of skate close to death to get the points and pickups and stuff.
You do. There's lots of plus symbols that you need to kind of grind close to the wall almost. But this differs significantly from Wave, because Wave was very much like a left to right affair where you were zigzagging through up and down and dodging like that really fast. This has got more of a original Sonic the Hedgehog special stage vibe to it.
Yeah.
Where it's got the map is kind of almost spinning a lot of the time, so you're constantly having to remember which way is up, because as it continues to spin, now holding is actually making you go sideways, and now it's making you go down, so you have to kind of keep your bearings as to which way you are oriented in the map while it turns and spins. And the maze kind of just branches out. It feels like, obviously, it's just generated every time you play it at random, and so you're just kind of snaking your way through. Did you go for the hard modes?
I didn't. I had to jump in this podcast instead.
So, yeah, the hard modes completely change the way you play it. So the easy modes are just holding, and it holds the screen and it, you know, advances up. The snake snakes along and release, and it snakes down as opposed to up. The hard modes, you drag your thumb on the screen, and that's what makes the snake move around.
Oh.
Completely different game. And way, way harder. And, like, slightly trickier to play on iOS, because what I find is when I'm playing it, like, because it's doing a kind of one-to-one with how far you drag your thumb, there are several instances where I'm like, drag, I need to then kind of, you know, move my thumb to the bottom of the screen again and drag more and drag more. Oh, I've hit the thing because, you know. It feels like there's not quite enough play on the screen to do that accurately enough, but I only played that for 5 minutes. Maybe I'd get good at it and stop being a loser. But that was my initial feeling, like, this is perhaps trickier than it should be. But yeah, it becomes a completely different game at that point. I would suggest checking out both of these. This is available as a free game, so Wave Redux is the name of this. So if you just want it for the chill out and the nice beats, or if you want to try and really test yourself, cool. But go and check out Wave as well. It's like 6 years old at this point, but it was a cool little thing, and seeing the evolution from that to this. I'm not sure if it's an evolution, actually. It's just a different kind of game, but it's worth a look. So yeah, Wave Redux, that's a free-to-play game. It's only on the App Store at the moment, not Google, but we'll see if it ports its way over. We should probably talk about the big Geralt-shaped elephant in the room. Thronebreaker The Witcher Tales has arrived on iOS, which is exciting. Now, have you seen or played any of this?
I know what it is. I've never played it or seen anything of it, but I'm aware it's like it's the campaign mode of Gwent, basically, isn't it?
Pretty much, yeah. It's different to Gwent slightly in the way that the card battle works. But yes, it's like, imagine that the card battles that you play in Gwent are just the enemy encounters. Mm. But now imagine there's a massive isometric RPG wrapped around it.
Oh, okay.
And that's what it is. And we haven't got it on the joint account yet. It's £10 to download on the App Store. It looks fantastic. Like, it's it's gorgeous. It's an amazing-looking thing. It's doing the isometric style, but it's, you know, cartoony, I guess, more so than it is like... I know some of these things tend to lead towards, like, a 16-bit pixel art. That's not what this is. Mm. This is proper lovely artistry. This is full 3D characters. It's full voice acting cast as well, with that lovely animation that you get from, you know, that sort of quasi fake 3D animation you get in anime games.
Yeah,
I'm saying this to you because you will know whatever that engine is, which makes the 2D behave like 3D a little bit.
Yeah,
it feels like that's going on in the talkie scenes. But I watched about like 20 minutes of someone playing this. And I'm in. Like, this looks great. Like, the again, the card game stuff, I can get into them, but I'm not like a big card game guy, and that's what I love playing. So I played a bit of Gwent when it came out, but, you know, I didn't play it on The Witcher 3. I was too busy playing The Witcher 3 to stop and play cards in it, you know? Whereas this brings The Witcher 3 back. It's got the full RPG wrapped around it, and then it gives you the incentive to get into the card game to maybe advance the exploration and narrative stuff. But it feels like one of those, you know, old-fashioned Fallout 2-style isometric RPGs, Divinity Original Sin, you know, that kind of jam, only with card for battling. Now, I haven't played it, so I can't judge how good the card battling is. This has got great reviews when it originally came out. On PC it was originally arrived. So it's already well-regarded. But I just wanted to see what the fuss was about. And yeah, I want to play this. This looks fun as hell. I loved The Witcher 3, and I specifically like the RPG elements of it. And I like those old-fashioned ones, like your Fallouts and your, you know, things like that. So I'm gonna try and get it, or I'm going to try and bully someone into giving me a code for it. Whichever of those happens first. Not free-to-play. Premium, extremely premium. Thronebreaker The Witcher Tales, that's out on the App Store right now. There's a thing from about a week or so ago. I kind of meant to mention it at the end of last week, but I didn't. Sphaze. You heard of Sphaze?
I have not heard of Sphaze, but you mentioned that you were excited about talking about it, so I'm excited to hear you talk about it.
Never did. I'm going to mention it now, because this is I don't think I talked about it anyway. I'm now starting to doubt myself, and I think maybe I did talk about it.
Tell me about it quickly. Sum it up in 10 words or less.
Yeah, if we're all right then. Sphaze, puzzle game, oh, God.
That's seven.
we're already stuck there. No, I was going to say Uncharted, twisting puzzle with the stones aligning, but with a maze in it and a robot getting to the center.
Oh, okay.
That's not 10 words, but that's effectively what the game is. I feel like now I definitely mentioned it last week, but I was playing it again this week for video, and it's still really good, and people should really play it. I think it's got a £4.99 price tag on it, but the way I'm playing it, it's like the first level was for free, and you can unlock other levels. So I think maybe there's like a free version of it that you can get. So maybe look into that, and if you can play the first bit for free, then definitely do so. Sphaze, I'm going to say, so go grab that. The things that I haven't played that are on the list, so there's a game called Bird Alone.
Yeah, I haven't played this either, but it looks lovely, because it's by same team who do Hot Date, which is that one where you go on speed dating with pugs.
Speed dating with pugs?
Yeah.
The dogs.
Yeah, the actual dogs. It's just sort of a constant rotation of pugs. And they're all the same pug, but they have, like, different names, and you chat with them. The art style is the same pug every time, and you, like, go speed dating with them. Very weird, okay. Very fun on mobile. Do check that out. They also did Far From Noise, I think it is, which is, like, you have a conversation with somebody, but you're in a car that's hanging over the edge of a cliff, Italian job style.
Okay.
So they have a history of doing these weird, chill, calm games. And I think Cameron is really into Bird Alone.
Right. Cute. So yeah, this is you. That makes sense if they're talking about you dating a pug. This is about you chilling out with a bird. Hey. That's the pitch. So you're hanging out an actual parrot, it looks like. And it's a game that apparently it plays out in real time. So if you open it up, it will adjust depending on what time of day it is. And it's described here by Dan as like essentially a bunch of well-written conversations and mini-games mapped to the daily cycle. So from the gameplay footage that I've seen, it's like you open up and it's just like, hello. And you start having a little chat with this bird. And then it's like, oi, I've got these nuts over here I need to go and bury. Like, go and sort me out. That's probably what a squirrel would say, not a bird. Either way. And then you go off and you do a little mini game one, have a chat with this bird while it happens. And it goes on, like, you know, you can open it at any time and different things will be happening. You also get notifications. Your little bird sends you messages when they want to have a chat about bird stuff. As you said, looks nice. I like the cartoony art style. I'm going to talk to Cameron about this. I'll have to see if it's on the JA now. I want to have a chat with my bird pal. This seems cool. I don't want it to be alone. It's a good title because it's called Bird Alone. And you're like, aw, I'll go and keep him company. Go on, don't worry. We'll go and have a chat.
I will pay £3 to make sure this bird is no longer lonely.
It's a good hook, man. It's a good hook. So yeah, this is, I think it's App Store only at the minute, but as you say, $2.99, £2.99, if you want to go and play it. There was one thing I want to mention, because I remember covering this months and months ago. Haven't played it, but Emergent Fates. This is that Kickstarter one, isn't it? It's a like old-fashioned, as in like retro-looking RPG, which has been put together as part of some big and well-funded Kickstarter project. This is by the guys Megaphemeral. Mm-hmm. And it's doing the whole, oh yes, old-fashioned. Now, the reason I'm sort of covering it is because I kind of don't like the look of it. It looks like a lot of time has been spent on it. I do not gel with this art at all.
I'm trying to open up a picture of it now, and yeah, it's yeah, it looks a bit like fan art of a D&D podcast or something. And I don't mean to crap on people who make fan art for D&D podcasts.
No,
but yeah, little.
And it might just be me. Like, I don't know. It's not working for me. Mm. And I thought this at the beginning, because I remember seeing it was like a big Kickstarter success and all funding and yada yada. So like, cool, have a look at it. I was like, really, for this? but like, it might purely be a taste thing. I haven't played it. People were very excited to see it turn up. And Cameron, who I think has played it a little bit, says it doesn't get bogged down with the lore, feels it could work as like an introduction to the genre if maybe you're not as familiar. So it might be great. Don't take my dissing as any kind of judgment. So this is an App Store at the minute, and it's a premium game. Don't know how much it costs. Maybe we'll do a review and someone can actually give a proper opinion. But Emergent Fates is the name of that one. That'll do us for this week.
No. No.
Oh no. Oh no. Sorry. We're missing V. Right.
Don't you
pull up a chair, everybody.
Don't you dare.
Let's get serious here. I'm sorry.
Off this podcast without talking about Deadly Premonition 2.
No, hang on. I'm going to get comfy. I'm going to lean back a little in my chair. So Rick, you played a game this week.
Oh god, did I play a game this week? Oh Jesus Christ. So, yeah, I haven't done a review in about a year, and I saw, like, I got a code through or an email through, like, oh, do you want to review Deadly Premonition 2? And I said to Dan, I would love to review Deadly Premonition 2. Get me this code, I will do it for you. I love Swery65's work. I think he does really weird stuff. I don't know if you've played any of his work, like Deadly Premonition, D4.
I've played Deadly Premonition.
So you know what he's kind of all about. Very weird games that usually have sort of a rooting in reality and normality, but mostly because they're sort of pastiches of mostly Twin Peaks, but other stuff and that kind, of, that kind of ceiling in that setting. If you think about Twin Peaks, you know, that's kind of what he's sort of going for. So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of those games. I've never really played Deadly Premonition. I played a bit before doing this review because I have it, but haven't really got around to it. And it is that wonderfully weird, you know, you're in a backwoods town and you're solving grisly murders and that kind of thing. And there's also otherworldly elements to it. And your character's this weird cinephile called Francis York Morgan. And yeah, he feels like a fish out of water constantly, and everybody else seems way more normal than him. And he's just a rude, rude man. and that's kind of the whole
very boring driving.
Yeah, that's kind of the whole setup of that. And the Deadly Premonition 2 is both a prequel and a sequel to Deadly Premonition 1, in which so the framing device is that you are two FBI agents in 2019 investigating a case that Francis York Morgan. Worked on
Francis Ford Coppola.
Francis York Morgan worked on in 2005 before the Greenvale cases of Deadly Premonition 1. So it kind of like sets up the original investigation, because at the start of Deadly Premonition he's driving through his car and he goes, oh, these babies have taken us all around the world, and there's the little red seeds. This is kind of to set up like the red seeds and that whole thing.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it takes place in the Deep South, so you're in a small Louisiana town called Le Carre, and it's the same sort of thing that you remember from Deadly Premonition. So all the weird mechanics where it's like it's a 24-day cycle. Mm-hmm. You have to sleep, you have to eat, you have to shower, you have to shave. They've removed driving completely. You have access to a skateboard, which makes you go a bit faster, and you can do tricks on sometimes. And it has a fast travel mechanic where somebody drives you around. They basically invent Uber in 2005 for jokes. So it's got all that sort of feel to it. It feels like a Deadly Premonition game. But it feels like, you know how The Room is an amazing film? Because Tommy Wiseau believed in it so much.
Right. So yeah, so this hits upon a certain thing about cult movies, which is when people try to make a cult movie, you can feel it. And it doesn't feel right. It feels like someone's making something deliberately bad in order to be like, right, guys, right?
Exactly.
We all know it's bad. And it's like, well, no, Tommy Wiseau thought he was making a masterpiece. It was just so bad. And the lack of self-awareness about the material is what makes it so hilarious.
And that's what I think is missing in Deadly Premonition 2. Because the team know that Deadly Premonition 1 wasn't exactly... It was, you know, it's the Guinness World...
Well, it was Yank,
yeah,
wasn't
it was the Guinness World Record holder of, like, the most divisive game of all time. Because it got 10 out of 10s, it got 2 out of 10s. And it feels like they're trying to just hit on that same magic. But it does it all with a wink and a nod. And it's like, oh, yeah, we've done this before, haven't we? This is a bit silly and all this kind of stuff. And there's a whole quest where it's like, it's a 2-hour long fetch quest, real world time, 2-hour long fetch quest. It took me so long to do. And the whole time you're doing it, York is like winking to the camera almost, because he speaks to Zach in his brain, and that sort of is your reflection in the world, and he's going, wow, Zach, this is a pointless fetch quest. And it's like, wow, I didn't need to be reminded of the fact that I'm wasting my time. It sucks that they put it in, and then it sucks that it's just a sort of a joke on you, the player, for wanting to stick with a Deadly Premonition game. That's my main problem with it. The other problems are numerous. So, if you've seen any footage of it, you'll see that it is ropey as hell. The actual movement, the frame rate. I'm not a person who complains much about frame rate because I play games on low-end spec PCs. I play Gone Home at like 5 FPS. I can handle low frame rate, but it's constant. It's horrible.
It looks like it's running about 10 frames a second, powerful.
But it's on Switch, so they should have access to better resources. They should know better, because this is like almost a decade after the first game came out. They should have known better that to make a game that actually runs, but it just doesn't, and that's really disappointing.
The first game was PS2. Remember,
it was like... Xbox 360. Was it
PS3?
Yeah, it was originally being designed for PS2, and then they cancelled it because they had memory limitations and rebooted it for Xbox. Anyway, and then like it's full of bugs and crashes. There are parts where I was like in the middle of a huge fight and the buttons would stop working. And like I quit out of the game and like tested all the buttons. My controllers have been acting up, but it was fine. They were fine outside of the game. Got back in the game, buttons still don't work. They only started working after I got hit by an enemy. So there's just a weird sort of bug there. It crashed when I saved. It crashed when I was loading into a level. It soft locked after sort of speaking to an NPC. So they just stood there doing like, I think they were stood in front of a desk doing like this motion, and they just did that forever. And I couldn't move, and I couldn't pause, and I had to quit out. Thankfully, it does have an autosave, so these problems are not hugely impacted. You don't have to go back hours, but it does suck when you, like, you've just... I think that was at the end of this massive long quest, and it softlocked on me. And I was like, holy crap, if I have to do this 2-hour quest again, I'm going to kill, like, Swery. Not literally, I would never actually do that. What else is bad about it? The characters... So the thing about Deadly Premonition 1 is that some of the characters are really weird, but some of the characters are just normal people, and they sort of behave normally, and they're realistic. But Deadly Premonition 2, every single character has to have a weird quirk kind of thing. And that's
they're all
yeah,
kooks.
It's really grating. Because usually you would have, like, your main character is the center who's normal and fine, but he's not. So that's just weird if everybody else is also, like, a crazy kook kind of person. Which I found really grating. It tries its best to be friendly towards its queer characters and then forgets to do that for plot relevance points. I'm not going to go too much into detail on that because of spoiler territory, but a major plot hook hangs off badly representing queer characters, and I feel like that isn't getting talked about enough in the reviews. So that's really disappointing because... Swery did The Missing before doing this, and if you know anything about The Missing, that's a fantastic story about queer characters. Really well written, really well handled subject matter, really grim, dark, but still like handles it well. And this just feels like going back to a time before that, and Swery not really, the writers not really understand what's going on. It feels like a different writer to handle that topic, and that's really jarring and upsetting in many ways.
I like from reading around it, and that's the subtitle from watching reviews and watching like gameplay footage, because I was like, how bad can this be? And yeah, my God, it does look like a PS2 game. It doesn't look like a PS3; it looks like a PS2 game. Which again, people are going like, hey, that's the point. And the same, and you're seeing the frame rates and the crashes, and you're like, wow. But particularly the frame rate, and I love the fact that this got brought up, and apparently Swery's just like, they're going, are you going to patch this? Because this is a hell of a stay. And he's like, no.
They have clarified. They've said that they might patch it in the future, maybe. Yeah.
Really? Because the initial response was like, nope, we're doubling down on this deliberately bad game. And this is a great... I mean, that's the problem. It becomes this very difficult thing to read when you're talking about, hey, it's deliberately bad. Because it's like, that is either a legit choice that you're making, and arguably you could say it's a good or a bad choice. Probably, I would probably argue that it's bad if you're making people play a bad game deliberately because, hey, bad, right? And there's no kind of saving grace. It's not like charmingly bad, it's just bad. Or the other thing is you made a bad game and now you're telling everyone you're doing it on purpose as a get-out-of-jail-free card, which is the other thing. Like, oh, no, we meant that to be rubbish. And we meant you to get, like, you know, we meant it to crash your Switch over and over again. It's like, no, you didn't. It's just badly made.
I think like, there's a way of making bad games where they're still playable. And I think that's the problem, is that this is basically unplayable unless you're willing to just stick with it for hours and hours and hours. My final runtime came to about 17 hours. Before I got to the end, and I was done after about 5. I was sick of it at that point. Oof. Like it really riled me up by then. And then I had this 2-hour fetch quest that I had to do, and I was just done. But I stuck with it because I, you know, have to reviewing and I did want to see through to the end because I was kind of curious as to what happened. And the story is weirdly predictable. Like it's so weird, but all like everything's like telegraphed well in advance. So even though it's like a weird thing, there's details in it that are like, whoa, that's a bit. But the actual like story beats are kind of very predictable, and you kind of see where it's going, and then the ending just goes completely insane and does not make any sense. But that's a whole separate story. It's just
in my head. It was filed in the same place as the Shenmue sequel. So Shenmue 3 came out after, you know, how many years, and they announced it at the same time they announced Final Fantasy 7 remake. So like 4 or 5 years ago. And that's another game that like didn't get completed, and it's a beloved game, but again, beloved for the fact that it's sort of slow and oddly weird and yanky in the gameplay. The things that people hate about the game are the things that people love about it. It being a life sim and very tedious, and you have to wait for it to go 6 o'clock in the morning before you can go to a shop in real time and all that kind of stuff. And there are, you know, ardent lovers and fans of that game. And then when the new one comes out, it's like, yep, this is more of that.
Yeah.
And when it's being released at the same time, this is the same thing with the, you know, your game runs at 10 frames a second, which when you're playing old games, because I didn't play Deadly Premonition at the time, I went back and played it. And I'm like, well, this is yank, but clearly this is a game from, you know, 10 plus years ago. So it is what it is. And you are much more forgiving of that in context. When the game comes out today and into a world of ray tracing and Unreal 5 and everything, and then people are still going like, yeah, well, no, this is still good though, right? This is good. This is you like this? And you're like, I mean, yeah, you could have made it good. That would have been nice. Could you not have made it good? And I don't feel you get quite the same.
Yeah.
It's not like 16-bit art style, which is a, you know, an art style that works. If 16-bit retro games, which are released because they're retro and people like the art style, if they also like crashed your PC every 5 seconds and, you know, all the animations froze, and then that's not cute and retro, that's just annoying.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things where it's like, if we looked back in 10 years, even then we'd still think this is jank. Because you can just go play any other Switch game and most of them will run better than this. I think the problem that I'm finding with other, like, I don't want to cuss out other reviewers or anything like that, I think there's going to be start being this sort of conversation around Deadly Premonition 2 that becomes this one issue thing of it runs badly. And that is not the worst thing about the game. You can, like, once you've played it for about a few hours, you can kind of get used to the jank. You can kind of get used to that performance issues. It just becomes part of the background. I think there's major problems with the story. I think there's major problems with the mission design. I think there's major problems with the level design as well, because, like, the world itself is huge, like it was in Deadly Premonition 1, but because you don't have a car, it takes forever to get anywhere. And the sort of, you go into these other world sections to do combat, and they are just cut and paste corridors. And that's really boring and not interesting at all. And I think there's a lot of people that are just going to forget about all this because they'll see footage of it running at 10 frames per second and go, oh, that's the problem with the game. I'll love it anyway, yeah, because that's what the original Deadly Premonition was about. And I think we, you know, I don't want it. I didn't want this to be a bad game. I didn't want to dislike Deadly Premonition 2. I sought out the review because I thought this could be really good. And I'd seen footage of it running before and thought, this looks really janky. I'm sure it's going to be terrible to run. But I want to love it because I think it'll still have that weirdness. It'll still have that joy to it. But it just feels to me like a big cosmic joke that I'm not in on. Because it feels like it's a game that is constantly telling you, stop playing me. I hate you. Just stop doing this. You don't need to keep doing this to yourself. I get that. If that's a design idea, if that was the whole premise of the game, then yeah, fine, whatever. If this was a game that's like, this, you can only play this if you're a major masochist, absolutely, I'm all on board with that. I don't think, if that was the idea, that idea has come across very well. I think this feels too much like it couldn't decide whether it was being an earnest reminder of how good Deadly Premonition was, regardless of its issues, or it's a big joke. It sort of straddles the line between the two. And doesn't work as a result. So 3 out of 10.
Oh, sweary. Well, you're at the lower end, but you have seen more division, like with the first game. So we have had like 9s and 8s out of 10, but we've also had your end of the spectrum too. So it's once again Split Everybody, which are the funnest kind of game, or the funnest kind of anything, frankly. I love those movies where it's just like, you know, you either love or hate this. This is either very much your jam or not. But it's kind of a shame because I'd say I like the first one, but I was appalled when I saw the box art and saw that they had done the Seven
yes.
style
Dare 2E premonition.
Dare 2E premonition. Yeah, that doesn't work. Sorry, no, I'm not standing for that. I use Photoshop. No, that doesn't work at all on any level. So stop it. You've been told. But there you go. That's the extended director's cut of this podcast for the 20-minute slam of Deadly Premonition 2. Lovely. Well, maybe don't go and get it. Well, maybe do. Maybe maybe it's good. That's what you're missing the point, Rick. It's really good. That's the only thing I could think of. It's the old meme of, like, the game is supposed to be bad, you buffoon. That kind of, you absolute moron. That whole thing.
But I love bad games, right. And this just isn't a good one.
It's the wrong bad. Bad, not good bad. Okay, well, we'll leave everybody alone now. You've had your fill. Thank you all for watching, listening, and all the other stuff. Good to have you back, Rick, and we will catch up with you next week.
Bye-bye.